Hello, I'm Bill DeFelice. This is number 0393, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0393. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Glenn Frankel, author of High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist, and The Making of an American Classic. Which side was Gary Cooper on in this issue?
He gets to know Carl Foreman, because Carl's not only the writer of the script, but he's also the associate producer on this. And they get to know each other, and he gets to like him. So when Carl gets the subpoena, one of the first things he does is he tells Cooper about it. And he explains to him how he used to be in the Communist Party, but he isn't anymore. But he doesn't know what to do, and he even gives Cooper an out to sort of, you know, walk away from the movie. But Cooper doesn't do that. Cooper's not only a conservative Republican, but he's also a very intuitive guy. He liked Carl. He trusted Carl. They were working closely together. He believed him, and he tried to support him.
Science writer Andrew Vizakis, the night sky guy, on the recent NASA discovery of seven new planets.
Around this star, there is a group of seven planets that now we know exist. All of them are approximately Earth-sized, and three out of the seven are particularly tantalizing because they are in what's called the habitable zone, or the Goldilocks zone. That's what it's also affectionately called. This is basically a donut-shaped region around a star where it's not too hot or not too cold for liquid water to exist on the surface of planets.
Ernie Smith from Tedium is back on the show, sharing some of the history of home delivery. It all started with milk.
There's no modern context for that today. These days you go to a store, you buy milk, it's sort of a very easy process. But the thing with milk, and part of the reason why it was so essential way back when, and isn't really essential now, is that refrigeration didn't exist in many homes for, you know, much of the early part of the 20th century, late 19th century as well. And it sort of created a situation where they had to keep coming to your house every single day to refresh your milk supply.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0393 was Bill DeFelice, who is a broadcast engineer of more than 40 years who shares his knowledge of how anyone can start their own legal, license-free, low-power radio station in the U.S. under FCC Part 15 regulations. His free ebook, along with many more resources, are available at his website, which is hobbybroadcaster.net. That's hobbybroadcaster.net. And thank you very much, Bill, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. You know, folks, the Stuff File program is a listener-supported radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Be a patron of the show and find out about our rewards program. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the Stuff File program and even some of your ideas for rewards. So come on, participate and join us for the ride. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. And be part of the Stuff File Nation. Of course, the Stuff File program is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Okay, boys and girls, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, you know how dogs mark their territory? You know how humans are supposed to be above that? Well, apparently some fishermen never got that memo. One Florida fishing pier is cracking down on vengeful fishermen who have gone as far as defecating on the pier in order to mark their space. According to Florida Today, the good fishing at the Sebastian Inlet Pier has led to increasing disputes among anglers, including aggressive tactics like throwing fishing weights and gear at each other and boaters, and the boaters sometimes retaliating in kind. The problem doesn't quite end at night, or it doesn't quiet down, I should say, at night, leading officials to consider closing the pier at night because of injuries, including two victims who were taken to the hospital. We have reports of people defecating and spreading it on the rails to mark their territory so nobody will fish next to them, said administrator of the Sebastian Inlet District, Martin Smithson. There have been several citations for public urination. The Inlet District passed a resolution this month asking for help from law enforcement. District officials hope the pier will be patrolled 24/7 by Florida wildlife officers, but the question of funding and how a patrol would work remain. Now, no one has been arrested yet, but authorities are on the lookout. If caught, the crime of throwing a hard projectile into a boat in state waters is a second-degree felony, punishable by up to 15 years in jail and a $10,000 fine. Doesn't mention, though, anything about the fine for feces spreading. You know, we really are just a few chromosomes removed from apes, aren't we? Yeah. Still with fishing, here's a quote from a former commercial fisherman from Panama City, Florida. "This changed my life and way of thinking and also made me aware of some of the dangers that can be found offshore in the Gulf." Now, the event that changed his life? While fishing in the Gulf of Mexico, he found 20 kilos of cocaine floating in the water. His decision? Try to sell it, bringing in four others to help. Naturally, 32-year-old Thomas Zachary Breeding was caught, and all five pleaded guilty to conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance. They face up to life in prison and fines of up to $4.25 million. I'm sure they all, of course, blamed it on bad breeding. In so many ways, this fish story could be entitled The Catch of the Day. 24-year-old Amy Brown met a man online and they agreed to meet in person at a hotel in Lynnwood, Washington. As they lay on the bed, Brown asked the man several times if he was a serial killer. Police say that after he repeatedly assured her that he was not, she replied, "Well, I am a serial killer," and stabbed him in the chest. The man managed to escape and call for help and was hospitalized with a collapsed lung. Brown, arrested in the hotel's parking lot, allegedly admitted the crime to police, saying she planned to eat his heart and leave a note on his body explaining that she was planning to kill again. When asked why, she told officers, "I'm a loon!" Well, I'm not sure I like the idea of her disparaging one of Canada's beloved birds. As for the guy in this story, perhaps you should make your first dates in a more public place. Just saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Bavaria say they were able to track down a man responsible for a hit and run by following the hoof prints and manure left behind by the horse pulling his carriage. Police said the 78-year-old man scraped a car parked at the side of the road as he trotted through a town near Schweinfurt. The man continued on without reporting the accident, but an eyewitness reported the incident to police. Police say the trail of hoof prints and manure led them to the suspect's stable, and he confessed to the accident when confronted. He's responsible for about 2,000 euros in damages. Wow, following a trail of hoof prints and manure reminds me of a bad date I once had. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Glenn Frankel is a longtime Washington Post reporter, editor, bureau chief, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest project explores the Hollywood blacklist and the making of the classic Western High Noon. The book is High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Glenn joins us on the line right now from Virginia. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Peter. Nice to be here.
Thanks for being on the program with us. When we talk about the Hollywood Blacklist, one name keeps popping up, and that's Dalton Trumbo, and another movie keeps popping up, that is Spartacus. But High Noon has a connection to it as well that we don't hear much about, correct?
Yes, that's right. I mean, Spartacus and Trumbo marked the sort of death of the blacklist around 1960. But, you know, first off, there was the Red Scare era that really begins in 1947 when Trumbo, among 10 people, are called to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee about their communist connections. They refuse to cooperate, and they end up going to prison for up to a year for contempt of Congress. So that begins the whole story, if you will, of Hollywood's involvement with the Blacklist. By the time High Noon is shot in 1951, the committee has come back for, I guess you could call it a sequel, right? They had such a good time, you know, having movie stars and screenwriters testify, they decided to come back again. And that's the point where a screenwriter named Carl Foreman, who's in the middle of writing the script for High Noon, that's the point where he gets called to testify. He, like Trumbo, had been in the Communist Party. Unlike Trumbo, he'd left the Communist Party, but nonetheless, he was going to be a pretty prominent screenwriter, and they want him on the stand. And, you know, the problem is you can't just go on the stand and confess your own former connections to the party and say you're sorry. In order to prove your redemption, if you will, you've got to name the names of people who were in the party with you. You've got to accuse other people of being communists and subversives. And if you don't do that, you're going to lose your job. And that's the dilemma Carl Foreman faces as he's putting the finishing touches on the High Noon screenplay and trying to decide what he's going to do with this terrible, terrible choice.
Now, what about some of the backroom politics involved in this? I know during the Blacklist period, there were some stars who were on both sides of the issues, either defending those who were the writers who were blacklisted or railing out against them. For instance, where did Gary Cooper fall in all of this? He's the star of High Noon.
He is the star. He's an interesting case. He's a conservative Republican from Montana. Comes to Hollywood and becomes a big star very quickly. He's a strong anti-communist. He's one of the sort of founding members of this group called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. So his politics are very to the right. But he gets involved with High Noon, and, you know, in 51. He's 50 years old. The studio system, of which he was a great product and a great elite member of, it's beginning to crumble a little bit. And Cooper's not getting the great screenplays and the great roles he used to get. His health's at an issue. You know, he's got family problems. When he sees the screenplay for High Noon, he gets very excited because it's really good. And he wants to do it, and he even is willing to take less than half his usual big star salary to do it. So he gets involved, and then he gets to know Carl Foreman, because Carl's not only the writer of the script, but he's also the associate producer on this for a very smart little independent production company that's doing it. And they get to know each other, and he gets to like him. So when Carl gets the subpoena, one of the first things he does is he tells Cooper about it, and he explains to him how he used to be in the Communist Party, but he isn't anymore, but he doesn't know what to do, and he even gives Cooper an out to sort of, you know, walk away from the movie. But Cooper doesn't do that. Cooper's not only a conservative Republican, but he's also a very intuitive guy. He liked Carl. He trusted Carl. They were working closely together, and he believed him, and he tried to support him, to the point where when Carl does refuse to cooperate, and he is blacklisted, which means he loses his job, Cooper even agrees that he'll support a new little film company that Carl's going to set up. It doesn't happen in the end. The Blacklist is just too strong, and so it fails, and Cooper backs away. Nonetheless, he tried hard, and it's interesting to see how this personal relationship and trust, you know, overcome, you know, ideological differences.
In addition to those who may have had communist leanings or those who even just tinkered with the idea of it, there were other people who were caught up in this dragnet, if you were. American Jews became a special target, right?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, it's a moment of great anxiety, I would say, in our history. We think of the early 1950s as some, you know, wonderful golden time when everybody got along and, you know, and prosperity reigned. I think our new president, you know, talks about the 1950s as the era he'd like to take America back to. But in fact, it was a very turbulent time. We were locked in this really lethal Cold War with the Soviet Union. We had atomic weapons, and they were about to get them. We're losing young men in Korea, fighting communists in North Korea, and eventually the Chinese. You know, this is a tough era, and the politics were toxic. They were vicious. They were just as vicious as the ones now. But people were looking for enemies. They were looking for people to blame. And the blame fell, as you suggest, on people who were considered communists, even liberals. And Jews were especially singled out because, you know, a lot of the communists had Jewish backgrounds. They were known to be part of progressive movements. And so all this is going on. In some ways, it was scarier than today. You know, the enemy now and the people we're afraid of are Islamic terrorists. But we're also, you know, blaming Muslims in general and worried about refugees and all this. And there's some real fear. There's some real reasons for these fears. But they, you know, but politicians take these things a long way further. Well, the same thing was going on then. In some ways, communists were even scarier because, you know, you could be a communist or I could be a communist. They looked like us. They went to school with us. And yet they were these nefarious sort of zombie-like figures who followed a foreign power and were going to destroy our democracy. So there was a lot of paranoia, a lot of fear, some of it fact-based, but a lot of it just taken by people who exploited it and made us all afraid of speaking our minds and of participating in our democracy.
You mentioned parallels to what's going on today, and I'm kind of curious. First, how long ago did you start writing this book, High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic? And why did you feel this was an important story to talk about now?
Well, I actually began around 2013, after just around the time my previous book on John Ford's film The Searchers came out. And I heard the story of High Noon. I got fascinated by it. It was the time of the Tea Party, I would say. And I saw some similarities right away because the Tea Party was, I think, basically a bunch of people who felt disenfranchised and disaffected and felt they were losing their country to other forces, to usurpers. Again, they were blaming Muslims. They were blaming people in the government. You know, they had a lot of targets for this. And that's what, you know, what the Red Scare era was about as well, trying to get our country back from the people who are stealing it from us, trying to get our popular culture back, like the movies, from the hands of people who are subverting it to some alien cause. So I found the sort of mood music of that time, of 2013 and end of the Red Scare era, to sound familiar. And I worked on, you know, off of that. And that's one of the reasons. But I just love American history, and I love those moments, especially in modern American history, where we face a crisis and where individuals have to make choices, bad choices, you know, and decide what they're going to stand up for and what they're going to concede. That really, so I had a good story with Carl and Gary Cooper and the Blacklist. I knew it had political resonance and historical resonance. I had no idea, though, that it would be people would be drawing parallels now and be very interested in it. And the echoes now are unmistakable.
Well, you used formerly confidential records to create this portrait of for this book that you did on looking at the Red Scare and its victims, the Red Scare campaign and its victims. You obviously knew about the story beforehand going into it. In doing your research, what was a revelation even to you or an aha moment?
That's a really good question. Well, you know, I found a lot of good material in the National Archives from the House Un-American Activities Committee. The great books about the Hollywood Blacklist were written in the early 1980s, but, you know, 50 years after the hearings were over, just about all the papers were made public. It was interesting to see, for example, how one character, a guy named Martin Berkeley, who was a screenwriter and former communist who took the opposite position from Carl Foreman. He was the champion name-namer, 170, 180 people altogether. There were these secret closed-door hearings where I could see the way Martin manipulated the committee to get them to do what he wanted and to, you know, egg them on. He was very clever at it. He succeeded. He made himself sort of the king of the anti-communists when it came to denouncing folks. That was psychologically very revealing, both of him and of the people on the committee. But there's lots of good stuff in those hearings, in those closed-door hearings. And also I found out some good stuff in Hollywood, including Carl Foreman had produced a bunch of interviews for a memoir he was going to write. He never wrote it. He died young. But those interviews were available, and they really took me inside his reasoning and his desperation when the time comes and he has to decide what to do.
It's a fascinating story indeed. The book is called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Glenn, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's been a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you.
Well, it's been great to talk to you, Peter. Thanks a lot.
Glenn Frankel, author of High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist, and The Making of an American Classic. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0393, and you'll find links to Glenn's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about some new planets out there. Maybe a new place to call home. Ooh, Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, will be on the show. Plus, Ernie Smith from Tedium talks about the history of home delivery. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. An Oshawa, Ontario man wanted to make jewelry, but he apparently failed to recognize how dangerous the ornament he was working with was. His necklace was to feature one bullet, and as he was removing it from a live shell with vice grips, the unnamed 50-year-old man effectively shot himself in the leg. The powder ignited in the bullet, causing it to explode, Durham Regional Police said. The man indicated he was trying to make a necklace and didn't realize this could happen. Remember, everybody, things designed to go bang sometimes do. And while we do have strong gun control here in Canada, perhaps we should look into bullet control, too. Well, remember how people always said, "Don't speak ill of the dead"? Well, this isn't one of those cases. Leslie Ray Charpling died, and his Galveston, Texas family dictated his obituary. At a young age, Leslie quickly became a model example of bad parenting, the obit says, with the commitment to drinking, drugs, womanizing, and being generally offensive. He died at 75, which was 29 years longer than expected and much longer than he deserved. Further, he will be missed only for what he never did, being a loving husband, father, and good friend. He did serve in the Navy, but as part of a plea deal to escape sentencing on criminal charges. On the positive side, Leslie's passing proves that evil does in fact die, and hopefully marks a time of healing and safety for all. The family, needless to say, did not hold a memorial service. Remember, folks, family always has the last word. And in a similar vein, relatives of a 91-year-old Ohio woman who died this week are giving her the last word with a sassy, occasionally profane obituary that starts with the basics. "I was born, I lived, I died, and instructs people to wait the appropriate amount of time before trying to claim her stuff. They wrote it in Jean Odie's perspective, recapping the people important to her, adventures she had, and her favorite activities, including playing cards and teaching her granddaughter dirty songs. Her daughter, Casey Odie Clark, tells the Columbus Dispatch, the obituary celebrates a blunt woman who lived unapologetically. It also promises an after party following the funeral, but warns, if you are sick, don't bother to come. I might be dead, but I still don't want your germs. Wow. Now, that's a gal after my own heart. She sounds like the definition of spunk, doesn't she? Yeah. A burglary suspect was arrested after Wichita Falls, Texas police caught him fresh out of the shower in a stranger's home wearing Betty Boop pajama pants that didn't belong to him. The victims arrived home at about 5 p.m. and heard 37-year-old Brad Vaughn taking a shower. They saw signs that he had broken into the residence and called 911. Officers found Vaughn in a bedroom with his clothes on the floor, wearing only Betty Boop pajama pants that belonged to one of the victims. The homeowners don't know Vaughn. He was charged with burglary of habitation. He remains at the Wichita County Jail on a $10,000 bail. So, Betty Boop pajama pants. Do you think he put on the first thing he came across? Or did he go rummaging through the drawers and thought that maybe these brought out the color in his eyes? What's your guess? And finally, in this section of Stuff All News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, an 11-year-old, a BB gun, and a beehive. How do you think this story turns out? Yeah. Ambushed by bees, an Arizona boy is healing at Phoenix Children's Hospital after one of the most terrifying moments of his life. Andrew Kuntz's family says the attack also sent at least 3 emergency responders to the hospital. Stung nearly 400 times and allergic to bees, they say it's a miracle he's alive. It felt like 400 bullets were shooting me, Andrew said after being stung. The 11-year-old was playing with his BB gun near his Safford home when he unknowingly shot at a hive of Africanized bees. Sure, always blame the Africans. I tried to run, Andrew said. He couldn't really remember what happened after that. Andrew only knows heroes are the reason he's alive, and he still has his sense of humor. This isn't my real face, he said about his healing body. It's just numb. Okay, my question is, are his parents going to give him back his BB gun? Of course they are. Of course they are. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program, shall we? Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back on the program with us to talk about some potential new neighbors. NASA recently announced that there are 7 new planets that could hold life. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. He joins us via Skype from Orlando, Florida. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter.
We normally talk to you here in Montreal, but you're in Orlando, and now that there are 7 new planets, you're not anywhere near Cape Canaveral hoping to check out these new planets, are you?
Yeah, you know what? This sounds like a potential great vacation spot, I think, cosmic variety, that's for sure. I don't know. I mean, this is fascinating stuff, I'm telling you. If we only had warp drive, Peter.
Okay, so what can you tell us about these new planets? I know they are Earth-like, apparently, and they are circling what is known as a dim dwarf star?
That's right. So this is interesting. The setup here is basically you have a star that's cooler and dimmer than our sun. It's called a red dwarf. And around this star, there is a group of 7 planets that now we know exist. All of them are approximately Earth-sized. And three out of the seven are particularly tantalizing because they are in what's called the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone. That's what it's also affectionately called. This is basically a donut-shaped region around a star where it's not too hot or not too cold for liquid water to exist on the surface of planets. So this is amazing because three planets that are Earth-sized are in this sweet spot around this one star. So this discovery is really a standout. It's something that is unprecedented to have an entire system of seven worlds around one little star, and all of them being Earth-like, and three of them in a really great spot where we think it, you know, could be very conducive to life, the situation there. So I bet you anything that now many of the major telescopes around the world are going to be trained on this system and trying to tease out more information.
Okay, well, let's talk about not the seven planets, but those three that you say are in the so-called sweet spot. First of all, as you mentioned, this is a dwarf star. So does that mean it's smaller than our sun?
Exactly. It's a red dwarf star. It's actually a type of star. It's a very cool, like an ultra cool kind of dwarf. It's one of the most common types of stars in the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. The majority of these stars that are in the that make up the galaxy, which is, you know, we're talking about a population of about 400 billion stars. Many of them are these red dwarfs. They're so common. And this particular one is about 39 light years away, and it's in the constellation Aquarius in our skies. And it's too dim to actually see with the naked eye, but it's something that our telescopes were able to see. And they discovered these planets by using a technique called the transit method. And it's the most popular way of finding planets beyond our solar system. It basically watches the star's light output, and the brightness dips very slightly when a planet goes in front of the star from our vantage point here on Earth. So as the planets orbit their stars, if they happen to go in front of the star from our vantage point, the star's brightness dips very slightly. And that exquisitely small difference in brightness is packed with information, things like the density of the planet, the mass of the planet, and how far away it's orbiting, the diameter, how large the planet is. We can infer a whole bunch of characteristics from that light. And that's how these were found 39 light years away.
Okay, so again, the reason why I asked about the size of it and those three planets that are supposedly within the Goldilocks sweet spot is I'm assuming that they've taken into consideration the size of the star involved, because I'm guessing, in this case, truly size does matter. When you compare it to our sun, for instance, the intensity of the heat coming from it based on its size, it would be different if it were smaller and we were still the third planet from the sun. Would that not be correct?
Well, exactly, because the setup around this star, you have to adjust that sweet spot, that Goldilocks zone, you know, changes depending on the star power that's coming from the star. So light output, the heat output of these stars. So where, you know, if we look at our solar system with our own sun, the sweet spot, of course, Earth is right smack dab in the middle of that Goldilocks zone. It's about, we sit about 150 million kilometers away from our host star, the sun. Venus, that's a little bit closer to the sun than us, and Mars, which is a little bit farther away from the sun, are also they're basically skirting the edge of the Goldilocks zone in our solar system. Now, if we move over to this other star system called TRAPPIST-1, TRAPPIST-1 is 39 light years away, and it's a cool dwarf, and the sweet spot there is literally not 150 million kilometers away from the star like it is here, it's more like 2 million kilometers kilometers away from it. Can you imagine? So 1 year in these the three planets that are most interesting here that are within the habitable zone are all within 2 million kilometers from the star. And that's because the star is so much smaller, 80% smaller than our sun, and it's many times cooler. So our sun surface temperature is about 6,000 Celsius. There we're talking about 2,000, 3,000 at most. So those planets, to have liquid water on them, they really have to hug their parent star very, very, very closely. So that's why they're, I mean, one year on one of these planets lasts only a few days. Mm. So it's a real, very different exotic worlds we're talking about.
Now, I was looking at some of the simulations that were on the NASA website. People can go to the NASA website and find out more information about these seven planets. And at the time that I saw the simulation, I don't know if they changed it in the last couple of days, but it seemed to be that those planets were all lined up, as opposed to our planets and our going around our sun. They're staggered orbits.
Well, what's interesting here, I mean, we don't know too much about this, but those drawings, those are artist illustrations based on the scientific evidence that they've collected from data over a number of years. But they, the planets are very close to each other, that we know. And that's why it was so difficult to find these planets. We've known about the TRAPPIST-1 star system for a while, but we haven't been able to, it was only in the last year that we really were able to tease out enough data that to differentiate between all the planets and know that there's seven there. But they are all very close to each other. And what's interesting, if you and I were to stand on one of these planets' surface and we'd look up at the sky, we'd be able to see our neighboring planets up in the sky. And some of them would appear, appear as big or maybe even bigger than our full moon in our own sky that we see. And they appear to be, each one of these planets also appears to be gravitationally locked onto their star, meaning that one of the same side of a planet is always facing their parent star. So they're locked onto it gravitationally by the star. So that means one side of the planet, imagine, would be in perpetual daylight, while the other side would be in nighttime forever.
So it wouldn't revolve like our Earth.
Exactly. So it would be what we call tidally locked onto their home star. This what basically this would mean is that the environment on these planets would be extremely wild, very different weather patterns. They probably have very strong, extremely strong winds. If it has an atmosphere, these planets, if they do, because they're tidally locked, there'd be strong winds blowing from the day side to the night side and back and forth, and these really wild temperature changes would be existing. So it might not be the most hospitable planet in terms of a vacation spot for you and I, Peter.
Okay. Well, one last question. I've got just about a minute. This is a recent discovery. You said earlier that most of the telescopes now will be pointed in this direction to see if they can get a better look. I know it would take forever to launch something any probe of any kind to get there, but could they launch, say, a telescope, a powerful telescope, to get a closer look?
Definitely, you've hit the nail on the head with that, because the thing is that they're building now already a telescope that will replace the Hubble. It's scheduled to launch next year. It's called the James Webb Space Telescope, and it is going to have a more powerful vision than even the Hubble is. Right now, as we speak, NASA's Hubble Space Telescope is looking at the planets, and the next step is really seeing if there's an atmosphere to these planets, these potentially habitable worlds. Because it's one thing to, we're talking about Earth-like. The only thing Earth-like that we know at this point is that they are the size of relative to the size of the Earth, and they're sitting in the Goldilocks zone. The next step is to see if they have an atmosphere, something that's a thick atmosphere, something that's puffy, that's similar to Earth. And what's in that atmosphere, the chemistry of those atmospheres? We're going to have telescopes within the next 5 to 10 years that will be able to characterize, look at the chemical fingerprints of the atmospheres of these planets to tell for things like oxygen, methane, chlorophyll, perhaps, maybe even greenhouse gases. Can you imagine that? That would really be fascinating, because we're talking about signs of life, even plant life or even complex life,
okay,
technological civilizations as well.
Okay, so one last question, or a double question, and they're yes or no answers, and that is, this new telescope you're talking about, it's more powerful than Hubble. That you said already. Will it go further from Earth than Hubble? Yes or no?
The telescope itself will be positioned farther out from the Earth. It won't be serviceable. It'll be over 1 million kilometers away from the Earth. It'll be specialized looking, and the reason for that is because it's using infrared vision. So it has to be away from the heat source of the Earth and the Moon.
Okay.
And so that's why it'll be positioned 1 million kilometers away, and it'll have much better magnifying capabilities.
Andrew, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being with us once again to explain this latest discovery by NASA.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's exciting times. Science fiction turning into science fact before our eyes.
Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy and author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com and visit our show page for number 0393. And you'll find links to Andrew's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Is a typical school day for a public school teacher too rigid? In other words, do teachers have the freedom to teach in ways that they view as most effective? A national survey of American public school teachers found that the percentage of teachers who perceive that they have low autonomy in the classroom rose by a whopping 44% in a recent 8-year period. Teachers have less autonomy these days because of a myriad of new government regulations aimed at increasing student test scores and making schools more accountable. Let's be fair, everyone wants to raise student performance, but some experts believe that by placing too many regulations on teachers, government is choking their ability to be creative. A little less red tape governing how classrooms run could help schools retain the best teachers and attract new ones to the profession. As Congress and the new president think of ways to reduce government regulations, many educators are hoping that they'll focus on rules that govern classrooms, too. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Ernie Smith from Tedium. He's going to talk about the history of home delivery. And if you haven't had a chance to check out his newsletter, TDM, it's really a great one. You should check it out. Get a chance to if you do. It's a lot of fun. And we're going to have Ernie on the show on a more semi-regular basis as the time goes on to talk about some of the things he discusses in his newsletter, because it's a lot of fun. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on here on a program. And I just want to remind you once again that you can join us on Patreon.com to make this show bigger and better. We really would like your support, because this is listener-supported radio, and it survives because of the fine folks like you who enjoy listening to it. So, if you can, do your part, and also give us some ideas and tips as to rewards we can offer for the show, and also maybe some of the things you'd like to hear on the program. So get back to us on that and let us know. We've got one more Stuff File news story I want to share with you before we get to our next guest here on the program, so let's get to it right now, shall we? A driver stopped at a traffic light in China and was recorded leaning out of the window of his van and using a slingshot to take out a traffic camera. The CCTV traffic camera footage shows the man, identified by the surname Li. Well, in China, that narrows it down, doesn't it? He stopped at a Shanghai red light in his blue minivan. Now, Li can be seen reaching for a slingshot and then reaching out of the van's window and using it to shatter the camera's lens. The impressive shot earned Lee an arrest from local police because, of course, it's a camera. So they saw him do it. He told officers he lost his temper because he had been waiting a long time for the light to change. Now, I'm not necessarily familiar with the customs in China, but why would someone actually be carrying a slingshot in their van? Is there natural use for this while driving? I wonder if he goes after jaywalkers, too. That's what I want to know. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back on the program. He's here to talk about a recent newsletter that took a look at the history of home delivery. Ernie joins us on the line via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Just tickety-boo. Nice to talk to you once again. As I said, I love the stuff that you do, and one that caught my eye was a recent one you did on the history of stuff being delivered to your door. And I guess one of the things that caught my eye when I first saw it is one of the things it mentioned, and I'm slightly older than you, so one of the things that it mentioned was the early delivery of milk, which is one of the first things that came delivered to your door. And it brought memories to me because I remember as a kid milk bottles coming to the door.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things where there's no modern context for that today. You know, these days you go to a store, you buy milk. It's sort of a very easy process. But the thing with milk, and part of the reason why it was so essential way back when, and isn't really essential now, is that refrigeration didn't exist like in many homes. You know, for much of the early part of the 20th century, you know, late 19th century as well, and it sort of created a situation where they had to keep coming to your house every single day to refresh your milk supply.
The thing that I also found interesting about, again, on Tedium, the depth of which you find information. One of the little pieces of information you have, which is 22.5, the number of trips that a milk bottle tended to hold up before it broke, according to a 1915 edition of Milk Plant Monthly. The fact that you even found a 1915 edition of Milk Plant Monthly just amazes me.
You know, and I was trying really hard to, like, you know, try to source everything very, very, you know, as much as I can. I want to make it so that if you read this and are just like, man, that doesn't sound right, like that you have evidence based on links, based on what's out there, that kind of tells you where to go. And I think in this case, this Milk Plant Monthly issue was linked off of in Google Books, which, you know, it's kind of a mixed thing. Like, for example, like sometimes you'll run into small snippets of articles on small snippets of books on Google Books, and sometimes you'll get lucky and you'll get the whole thing, which is fortunately what happened in this case. You know, and I try to do a lot of looking. Like, I'll look at old newspapers. The Internet Archive has so much stuff. It's, you know, I could dig through that site for an entire weekend and not even be bored.
This particular issue of Tedium was a great education on the whole idea of home delivery. You talk about the early days of the Montgomery Ward catalog. Catalogs were something that were very, very big for a long period of time in the last century. I remember shopping the Christmas catalog that would come from various department stores here in Canada, which was a big deal for me as a kid. It also ties in, and you've also tied it in this particular article, to the early days of just the postal service as a whole, right?
Yeah, I think that one thing that's really interesting about the postal system in terms of delivery is that in a lot of ways the two concepts kind of came up together. Like, you sort of had this thing that wasn't fully built out at first. You know, it's kind of like in a prior issue, I noted that the internet wasn't immediately global. It took time for it to reach all parts of the world. And the same thing with the mail system. Like, For much of the 19th century, it was really hard to get mail. It was really hard to get mail to people in rural areas. Just as an example, in the rural U.S., they didn't even have what was called rural free delivery until 1902 is when they finally said we got to have a way to get mail to people in rural areas on a regular basis.
This is one of the things you talk about, you discuss in the this issue of TDM, five postal innovations that made subscription services possible. You go on to talk about one of the things that a lot of us also remember, things like Book of the Month Club, which has made a resurgence. It seems to be that everything that is old is somehow new again, and that certainly is happening with home delivery. It's being reinvented for a new century, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what I find really intriguing about the Book of the Month Club is that it was kind of an old staid model until maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, when the concept basically came back to life through the internet using other products. Just as an example, things like Blue Apron, which delivers food on a regular basis, Blue Bottle, to go on the blue theme here. I actually use them personally to get coffee beans delivered to me every other week, and they're pretty good beans. I'll just say that. But it's one of those things where this model has been kind of reinvented and rethought out thanks to the internet. But if you go back to the 1920s or so, the Book of the Month Club had many, if not all, of the elements of this approach already set out. And there were other services over the over the history of the last century that kind of covered similar territory. I'm sure you might remember Columbia House, which sent CDs to your door every single month.
I was a member. Not I know Columbia House. Yeah.
Yeah, 12 CDs for a penny. That was a real thing. I think the Book of the Month Club is really interesting because there was a decision process that it took the founder of it, Harry Sherman, a little bit of time to get to. He didn't originally, come to the Book of the Month Club. Like, it wasn't like a fully formed idea that he just came up with one day, boom, I had it. He actually spent time working in public relations and marketing, and he met a couple of people that were trying to sell like these gimmicky books that were bound in leather. They were incredibly cheap books. They didn't look very nice, but they were sort of like the paperbacks of their day. And he figured out ways to market them very, very effectively at first by putting them with other products like chocolates, for example. But then he ended up taking them and starting to mail them out. And that eventually petered out, but it led to the idea of the Book of the Month Club, which is basically that every month we're going to curate these really awesome books and find one or two that you're really going to like, and we'll mail them to you. And they had this whole process where they had a committee that actually decided, here are the books that are so good that we're willing to mail them to you. So they had a high standard. But this actually proved kind of controversial a little bit, just because you had these overseers of the culture kind of deciding everything. And that meant that many publishers are left out. So booksellers are upset that they had another option to get books, and then publishers are upset because not all of their books are getting picked. But when it comes down to it, the model for the Book of the Month Club was really clever. It kind of showed the potential of just delivering stuff in the mail to people on a regular basis. It turned getting stuff in the mail into something that was actually kind of fun. And I think that we're starting to see the resurgence of that with internet-related stuff.
And this is just the tip of the iceberg of what you talked about in your Tedium newsletter, which was entitled Delivered to Your Door. By the way, I want to just mention very quickly, not only was I a member of the Columbia Club, I was the member of the Columbia Club back in the days when they were doing vinyl. And I was a member of the club beyond the CDs. I also got all the episodes of Star Trek and the Next Generation Star Trek on VHS.
Wow.
So, yeah, I was deep into Columbia House. Anyway, I thank you, Ernie, once again for being on the program with us. People can find out more information by going to your website, tedium.co. They can also find it on patreon.com. You have a Patreon page there. People can check that out as well. I thank you once again for being on the program with us. Hope to have you back in the future talking about one of your future endeavors in the dull side of the internet. Thanks, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter, Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0393, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. Also, please check out Ernie's page on Patreon. You'll find it at patreon.com/tedium. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the moment you've all been waiting for. Yes, boys and girls, it's the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
20-year-old Willie Anthony and 16-year-old Jamarqua Davis were arrested in Kannapolis, North Carolina in February after police said they broke into a rent-a-center at 2 a.m. and stole a big-screen TV. After loading the set into one car, they drove off in separate vehicles, but in their haste, smashed into each other in the parking lot. Now, both men subsequently drove the wrong way down South Cannon Boulevard, and both of them accidentally crashed separately into other vehicles, allowing police to catch up. Anthony and Davis were charged with a litany of crimes, including breaking and entering, felony larceny, possession of a stolen vehicle, hit and run, and driving without a license, because they always fail to have a license in these stories. Now, why, oh why, would you crash into your accomplice's vehicle in your escape, then both head the wrong way, heading against traffic, causing other accidents in your botched robbery? Well, one reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0393. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0393. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.